Mimi Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If Hezbollah decides to enter the war, it will long for the second Lebanon war. They will be making the biggest mistake of their lives, and we will hit them with an unimaginable force. It will mean devastation for them and the state of Lebanon.
As the death toll from Israel's 18-day bombardment of Gaza nears 5,800, tensions escalating on the Israel-Lebanon border. Tens of thousands of residents have evacuated their homes as Israel and Hezbollah exchange fire on a daily basis. We'll get the latest and look at how Israel's endgame in Gaza is to push Palestinians into Egypt. And we'll look at how U.S. policy toward Latin America has fueled historic numbers of asylum seekers. Over the weekend, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador met with other Latin American leaders calling for the U.S. to end its blockade of Cuba.
One of the agreements of yesterday's meeting was to promote bilateral dialogue between the United States and Cuba to resolve pending issues, especially those related to the blockade of Cuba, which greatly affects the population.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Health officials in Gaza say Israel's unrelenting bombardment of the besieged Palestinian territory has killed another 700 people over the past 24 hours, bringing the death toll over the past 18 days to about 5,800. More than 2,000 children are among the dead. 1.4 million Gazans, or more than half the territory's population, have been displaced. The UN reports at least 42% of Gaza's housing units are damaged or destroyed. In northern Gaza, the Indonesian hospital ran out of fuel Monday and suffered a power outage that brought life-saving medical equipment offline before officials restored power. Gaza's health ministry says it will run out of fuel for electric generators at other hospitals within the next 48 hours. It reports 32 of Gaza's health centers are out of service. Elsewhere, officials at Al-Wafa Hospital in Gaza City say the building's entrance and surrounding areas were targeted today in an Israeli airstrike. Meanwhile, a convoy of trucks carrying humanitarian aid remains stalled on the Egyptian side of the Rafah border crossing into Gaza. So far, Israel has allowed fewer than 100 trucks into Gaza, which aid groups call a drop in the ocean of what's needed to provide for Gaza's 2.3 million people. A spokesperson for the World Food Program says a critical shortage of fuel is preventing bakeries in Gaza from producing bread.
Not have enough power to get the machines working. And unfortunately, some were also hit. And so with this, you know, the collapse of essential infrastructure, the lack of fuel to make sure that the machines are running, it's really making a situation that is already catastrophic worse.
Hamas has released two Israeli civilians held hostage in Gaza. On Monday, a Hamas spokesperson said 79-year-old Nurit Cooper and 85-year-old Yocheved Lifshitz had been let go for humanitarian reasons and poor health grounds. Hamas shared videos showing armed fighters releasing the elderly hostages to Red Cross officials. Just before the video ends, Lifshitz reaches back to shake the hand of one of her captors, saying shalom, the Hebrew word for peace. Earlier today, Yocheved Lifshitz spoke to reporters in Tel Aviv, describing a harrowing scene as she was kidnapped and driven off to Gaza on a motorbike with two Hamas fighters, then forced to walk for miles through a network of underground tunnels. Once in Gaza, Lifshitz says her treatment improved. She says she was seen by a doctor, fed well, and had the opportunity to wash. Her daughter, Sharon, translated her remarks to reporters.
My mom is speaking about the time there. She's telling us about sharing food with the people, that the people, when she first arrived, they told them that they are Muslims and they're not going to hurt them, and that they shared, they ate the same food that their the Hamas was eating.
Israel believes about 220 other hostages remain in Gaza, including the husbands of both women. Hamas has now released a total of 4 women. The United Nations warns nearly 20,000 people across southern Lebanon have fled their homes amidst escalating violence on the Lebanese-Israel border. On Monday, the Biden administration said it's readying plans to evacuate hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens across the broader Middle East in case Israel's assault on Gaza provokes a wider war, including 600,000 Americans in Israel and another 86,000 in Lebanon. French President Emmanuel Macron has arrived in Israel for meetings with top Israeli officials. In Jerusalem, Macron told Israeli President Isaac Herzog he stood shoulder to shoulder with Israel and pledged France's full support for Israel's bombardment of the Gaza Strip. Macron urged Israel to avoid what he called a dangerous escalation in the region. Herzog said he also wanted to avoid a wider war, but said Israel stood ready to attack Lebanon if Hezbollah continues cross-border assaults.
I want to make clear, we are not looking for a confrontation in our northern border or with anyone else. We are focused on destroying Hamas infrastructure and bringing our citizens back home. But if Hezbollah will drag us into war, it should be clear that Lebanon will pay the price.
French media report Macron will head to Lebanon and Egypt next. His visit to Israel comes a day after some European Union foreign ministers endorsed a humanitarian pause of Israel's attacks in Gaza. In Washington, D.C., President Biden Monday ruled out U.S. support for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza while Hamas continues to hold hostages. His remarks came as the Pentagon dispatched military advisors and high-tech air defense systems to Israel ahead of Israel's expected ground assault on Gaza. In Canada, a member of the Ontario Legislative Assembly has been censured and expelled from her caucus after making remarks in solidarity with Palestinians. Sarah Jama, who is Black and a disability justice advocate, addressed her colleagues Monday.
I restate my call for an immediate ceasefire by Israeli forces and for the immediate restoration of food, water, fuel, and electricity in Gaza. And I applaud the many elected officials Order. In Canada who have joined this call in recent days, and I hope even more of you will speak out.
Jama now sits as an independent after being removed from Ontario New Democratic Party caucus. Her censure would only be lifted if she issues a formal apology for her remarks. In India, several students were detained in New Delhi Monday as they led a protest near the Israeli embassy demanding a ceasefire in Gaza.
Yet our government, yet most of the countries in the world who hold power are just ignoring the fact as if nothing is happening. Children are dying, hospitals are being bombed. I don't have anything new to say except for the fact that we shouldn't be denied the basic voice that all the students should have in this country.
Here in the United States, pressure is mounting on more Congress members to join calls for a ceasefire. On Monday, protesters in Albuquerque, New Mexico, held a nonviolent sit-in at the offices of Senators Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan, led by Jewish peace activists. 9 people were arrested. The protest came as hundreds of congressional staffers issued an open letter urging lawmakers to support a peaceful resolution to the attacks on Gaza, the return of Israeli hostages, and to grant access to humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Only 18 U.S. lawmakers have signed the ceasefire resolution so far, including Congress members Greg Kassar, Pramila Jayapal, and Ilhan Omar. In Ukraine, the governor of Kherson says 2 people were killed and 14 others injured earlier today by Russian artillery fire. This follows a Russian missile strike in Kharkiv on Sunday that created a massive hole in the roof of a postal distribution center, killing 6 people and injuring 14 others.
There was a missile attack. We were working. There was an explosion. Everyone started running away. I did what I could. As much as I managed to, I provided the necessary first aid. Some were stable. They had shrapnel wounds. Some were light. Some more serious. But some people were in critical condition. Ambulances took them away.
In eastern Ukraine, officials in the Russian-controlled city of Donetsk said Ukrainian artillery fire killed one civilian, wounded another. Elsewhere, Russia's navy says it repelled attacks by uncrewed boats launched by Ukraine at Russia's Black Sea Fleet. And Ukraine says it shot down 14 Russian attack drones and a cruise missile. Back in the United States and Texas, Lubbock County officials have approved an ordinance banning pregnant people from traveling through the region to seek an abortion in another state. Lubbock is the largest Texas county to join such efforts. At least three other rural counties have also passed similar measures. Lubbock resident Shelley Kemp denounced the move as she addressed county commissioners Monday.
You are going to create a culture of fear and distrust where you set neighbor against neighbor. It's going to have a chilling effect. Just for example, the language used, abortion tourism and trafficking, that immediately creates fear and distrust.
The United Auto Workers has expanded its strike against the big three U.S. automakers. On Monday, 6,800 auto workers walked out of the Stellantis Sterling Heights assembly plant near Detroit, Michigan. The UAW notes Stellantis made $18 billion in profits last year. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares earned total compensation of nearly $25 million, earning as much per day as an average Stellantis employee takes home in a year. UAW President Sean Fain joined workers on the picket line Monday.
They've made a quarter of $1 trillion in the last decade. I mean, Stellantis alone made $12 billion in the first 6 months of this year. They can afford this. They can make it happen. Our workers deserve their share. I mean, while they say they can't afford this, the next day they announce more dividends for shareholders.
Here in New York, the prestigious Community and Cultural Center on the Upper East Side, 92NY, formerly known as the 92nd Street Y, has temporarily postponed its literary reading series as it faces growing backlash for canceling an event with the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Viet Thanh Nguyen over his criticism of Israeli violence and Palestinians and calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. In response, a number of writers scheduled to participate in the months-long series pulled out, while several 92NY staff resigned from their jobs. Writer and critic Andrea Long Chu, who's among those who pulled out of the series, referred to 92NY as a pro-war nonprofit. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
As the death toll from Israel's 18-day bombardment of Gaza nears 5,800, tensions escalating on the Israel-Lebanon border. Tens of thousands of residents have evacuated their homes as Israel and Hezbollah exchange fire on a daily basis. We'll get the latest and look at how Israel's endgame in Gaza is to push Palestinians into Egypt. Stay with us. على حدود قلب الدن هويتي قلت لهم إن بيافا خبايتها ستي وقفوني على حدود قلب الدن هويتي قلت لهم إن بيافا
At the border,
Order by Marcel Khalife. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Authorities in Gaza say Israel's massive bombardment has killed another 700 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, bringing the death toll over the past 18 days to about 5,800 Palestinians. More than half of Gaza's population has been displaced. Israel's continuing to reject growing international calls for a ceasefire or a humanitarian pause. The World Health Organization's pleading for more aid to be allowed into Gaza, where 12 hospitals and 32 health centers have been forced to close. Earlier today, the Ministry of Health in Gaza issued a statement announcing, "We declare the complete collapse of the health system and hospitals in the Gaza Strip." The announcement came hours after the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza Strip went dark overnight as it ran out of fuel, but power has since been restored. On Monday, Hamas released two Israeli women who'd been held hostage, 79-year-old Nurit Yitzhak Cooper and 85-year-old Yocheved Lifshitz, were seized on October 7th in the Hamas attack that left about 1,400 people dead inside Israel. As the two women were being released, Yocheved Lifshitz shook hands with one of her captors and could be heard saying shalom, which means peace in Hebrew. Israel believes about 220 other hostages remain in Gaza, including the husbands of both women. As Israel continues to threaten to launch a ground invasion of Gaza, tensions escalating on the Israel-Lebanon border, where Israeli troops and Hezbollah are exchanging fire on a daily basis. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has threatened to devastate Lebanon if a new front in the fighting emerges.
I can't tell you now if Hezbollah decides to fully enter the war. If Hezbollah decides to enter the war, it will long for the second Lebanon war. They will be making the biggest mistake of their lives, and we will hit them with an unimaginable force. It will mean devastation for them and the state of Lebanon.
In Washington, D.C., State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller warned Hezbollah against escalating its attacks on Israel.
And so that we continue to make very clear our messages to anyone in the region who is hostile to Israel, that if they are considering attacks, they should reconsider them. And that's why the president ordered the deployment of two carrier strike groups to the eastern Mediterranean.
We're joined right now by Rami Khoury, a Palestinian-American journalist, columnist with 50 years' experience in the Middle East. He's a senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, former executive editor of the Daily Star in London, in Lebanon. He is joining us from Boston. Rami, thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about what is happening on Israel's northern border with Lebanon as tension and violence escalate.
What's happening is something that's happened many times before in the last 30 years or so, but it's slightly different this time. Hezbollah has become a very powerful force with huge capabilities in technology, missiles, intelligence, secrecy, etc., every aspect of warfare. They're also a much bigger force now than they were in the 2006 war because of the mobilization of troops who fought in Syria to defend the Syrian regime. They have a lot of experience, a lot of technology, and more importantly, they're linked to a regional, what they call an axis of resistance, which is Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, Hamas, Ansarullah, which is the Houthis in Yemen, and smaller groups in Syria and Iraq. There's a constellation of forces that of various degrees of capability, and they call themselves the Axis of Resistance. And the northern front of Israel and Lebanon now is far more dangerous to Israel if a war breaks out than it was before because of this regional capability. And Hezbollah's strategy has also evolved. It's not going to fight Israel by itself if it comes to that. I would stress that I believe firmly that neither Israel nor Hezbollah want to initiate a war. They've done it before. They've both suffered huge disruption and destruction. And they know that a full war now would be way more destructive, and civilians mostly and national infrastructure would suffer. And Hezbollah has planned for this, and its strategy to hit key strategic industrial transport energy nodes, which it can reach with its rockets. They have precision rockets. They are very good at moving into Israel surreptitiously. They've done it. They sent a drone over the nuclear facility at Dimona, I think, a few years ago. So the tension at the northern border of Israel, southern border of Lebanon, is designed to send messages back and forth between Israel and Hezbollah that they're prepared to fight if they need to, but they'd rather not. So they do tit-for-tat maneuvers. Also, there's an element here of testing. The Hezbollah is very good at this. They're very serious strategic people, whatever you may think of them. So they don't just, you know, buy new weapons and try to use them. They test out things. They see how Israel reacts. They do a little attack here, a little attack there. They send a few troops over the border. They send a drone. They do some missiles. And they see how Israel reacts. Israel has evacuated villages from 5 kilometers along its northern border, so that's a huge disruption already. And this is part of Hezbollah's strategy. They want to keep testing Israel, probing it, challenging it, taunting it. And they want to disrupt Israel's basic social and economic functioning. And the key aim of this in the long run is to, knock down Israel's exaggerated sense of power and dominance. And, you know, Netanyahu is the prime example of this. I mean, Netanyahu is kind of like a Saturday morning cartoon character in the United States. He's a tough guy, and he's strong, and if he's challenged, he'll beat the hell out of anybody. And he just said that yesterday that if there's war in Lebanon, they're going to destroy Lebanon, and they're already destroying Gaza. And the Hezbollah strategy is to use the regional connections it has, along with its own capabilities, along with strategic ambiguity, to not allow Israel or the U.S. or anybody to know what really it's going to do, to destabilize the confidence of Israel, but also to hit society's sense of security. What happened in Gaza when Hamas attacked on October 7th, it was an incredible blow to the confidence of the Israeli people in the performance of its armed forces, who were overrun quickly, and some of them dropped their arms and ran away. So there's all kinds of different dimensions to, you know, the northern border. The simplistic cartoon-like diplomacy and analysis that comes out of most of the mainstream American media and the American government says that, there's a danger of a war between Hezbollah and Israel on the northern border. It's far more complex and nuanced than that. But there is a serious threat that Israel faces, which it might have to fight 5 different people at the same time if it came down to a regional war, which is, I still think it's not likely, but it could happen. And this is one of the key new factors, and it explains a little bit why Hamas has achieved what it's achieved, is that it's the coordination among these different groups resistance fighters across the Arab world and Iran. They coordinate very closely in training and equipment and strategy and communications and all kinds of things. So it's a whole new situation in the north, and the United States and Israel, I think, are making the mistake of analyzing the situation based on, you know, what happened in 2006.
But Rami Khoury, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Israel strategy, if Israel does want to prevent a regional war, why, for instance, what's your assessment of its repeated now bombings of airports in Syria and what the impact that could be on spreading the war?
Israel's been doing that for many years, bombing Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, and they are probably mostly bombing units that are close to Iran or linked to the transport of equipment or people from Iran to these different outposts where it has allies across the Arab world. That's the assumption that most people have. And these attacks are designed to disrupt this linkage between Iran and allies in Syria and other Arab countries. It doesn't work very well, though. I mean, the Israelis are quite sophisticated, but they're also quite simplistic and stupid when it comes to not learning the lessons of their own repeated strategy that doesn't work. You know, they say now they want to wipe out Hamas and take away the threat, and they say if Hezbollah gets involved, they're going to wipe out Lebanon. They said that four or five times. They occupied Gaza. They occupied South Lebanon. I was in Lebanon. I lived there for like 20 years, and I was there in the 2006 war. So they've done these things. They've caused great misery to Lebanon and Gaza. And where are the two strongest forces now that challenge Israel in a way it's never been challenged before? They're in Lebanon and Gaza. Why? Because Israel, in its tough guy Joe Palooka cartoon approach to diplomacy and warfare and relations across the region, relies simply on its ability to beat the hell out of anybody and destroy the countries. And you're seeing it in Gaza today. It's unbelievable what they're doing. And physically destroying society's basic infrastructure and human needs. But it doesn't work. They don't realize all this does is generate greater resistance a year or two down the road with greater secrecy, higher technology levels, more coordination, and a stronger sense of defiance. And I should add here that, you know, the Hezbollah and Hamas is an acronym for Harak al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, which means the Islamic Resistance Movement. Resistance is the key operative phrase in Hamas. Hezbollah calls itself, you know, informally the resistance, al-Muqawama. And resistance is a key, maybe the key driver of what these groups and others in the region are doing. And the Israelis don't seem to understand this because they're the ones being resisted. And with resistance, there's also defiance. So when the U.S. sent the Ford Naval Task Force a couple of weeks ago, and it warned Iran and its allies, you know, not to do anything, the next day there were three or four small little attacks against American targets or American allied targets in Iraq and in Yemen and other places. So defiance and resistance are two dynamics that are so significant in the mind of people who are standing up to both Israel and the United States and others. And this has to be appreciated much more seriously for anybody who's trying to analyze the region, and certainly for anybody who's trying to act politically or militarily or diplomatically, including the Israelis and the Americans, the Europeans, and others.
And all the attention in recent days has been on what the Biden administration and the U.S. is doing to support Israel. But there appears to be increasing division in Europe on what is happening. We're seeing the European Union and different states within Europe calling for a humanitarian pause, in essence, a brief ceasefire. Very different from what the United States is saying. I'm wondering your assessment of that.
Well, I think the Europeans are waking up to the fact that they're human beings, and they have to react like human beings, not like killing machines, which they've done recently following the U.S. And Israeli lead. The suffering that's been caused in Gaza is unbelievable, and the deliberate, cruel tightening of the it's not just the pressures, it's the total squeezing of Gaza to try to starve it to death or make it die of thirst or let the hospital stop running because they don't have electricity. This is a level of barbarism and cruelty that is probably hasn't been seen since medieval days. And the Europeans went along with the Americans in the beginning and said, oh, Israel can defend itself. And this is one of the factors that really social psychiatrists need to analyze and political psychiatrists have to analyze for us. Why did Europe and the U.S. and Canada and others so vehemently and totally support this this draconian measure by Israel to kill on an industrial scale that has never been seen before in this region? They killed 400 people 2 days ago, and they killed 700 people yesterday, and the world is just sitting there analyzing what's going to happen in this there or here or there. So there's a kind of lack of humanity. There's a lack of people using their minds and their hearts to analyze what's going on. And I tell you what the reason is. It's very simple in my analysis. I've been now 55 years reporting in the Middle East and doing analysis and traveling around, and I come and go to the U.S. all the time. I'm there now. I think it's become very clear since May 2021, 2 years ago, when we had the uprising in Jerusalem, and you had